Hello, I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
And I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're talking about the shortcuts we use in our own home kitchens, our all-time favorite cookbooks, and fermentation with our guest, writer Amanda Pfeiffer. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week.
Well, I noticed in a Business Insider that Chipotle has replaced Subway as America's favorite healthier fast food chain.
I saw that. I never really thought that Subway was all that healthy. I mean, I feel like certainly there are fresh vegetables, which pushes the health quotient up. But I never quite got the whole like, oh, eat Subway and lose weight. I mean, to me, their bread is so crappy that how can that ever be a health food? But I do feel like Chipotle is slightly more virtuous.
I never was a big Subway fan, and I couldn't exactly put my finger on what I didn't like about it until I heard comedian Pete Holmes' bit about Subway, and I really suggest that everyone Google Pete Holmes' Subway bit because it made me laugh until I cried. But it really just brings to light like the slimy lunch meat, the weird smell in every Subway, like, and then of course there is that really industrial weird bread, like,
yeah.
So I, too, never really thought of that as a good alternative. And what I think people find healthy about Chipotle is the customization.
Yeah.
Because everyone has such a different idea of what healthy is.
Mm-hmm.
And at Chipotle, you can just, make up, particularly when it comes to, like, their bowls, what is healthy to you.
Yeah, no, that's true. Like, you know, if you're eating low carb, you can go in and get a salad without any rice and or, you know, if you're someone who is eating vegetarian, you can go in and get something that is totally vegetarian. So I can see how their options on their menu to make sure that it feels healthier.
The story mentioned that the average Chipotle order is close to 1,100 calories, which...
Yeah, that's terrifying.
I don't think that's healthy by anybody's standards, but I do think we're entering sort of an era where calories are less important. For one, don't typically think about the calories in something that I eat as much as I do the nutrition of the things that are on the plate. Do you consider calories before?
I don't really consider calories. I mean, I think about sort of volume that I'm consuming, but I'm not like looking at a plate of food and calculating the calories. I mean, certainly as a teenager, I was really good at that.
Oh.
but not anymore. I've tried to let go of that sort of knowledge base about calorie
estimation. I think anybody that grew up when we did in the 80s and 90s is really good at least one type of math, the calorie math.
Yeah.
Not that I think that it was such a good use of our brain space, but yeah. I do try to, I was really influenced the way I think about food by Gary Taub's book, Good Calories, Bad Calories.
Uh-huh.
And it sort of dispels the calories in, calories out theory of nutrition. And now I definitely think more about the quality of the food that I'm eating as opposed to the calorie count.
Well, and I feel like with Chipotle, I travel a lot and Chipotle is one of the reliable places to go to get vegetables. And for me, one of my focuses when I'm feeding myself is how many servings of fruits and vegetables can I eat in a day? And Chipotle is one of the places where you can reliably get a salad and then add some fajita vegetables and turn it into something where you're getting like 3 or 4 servings of vegetables. And that I appreciate.
Yeah. I like the same things about it that I like about Farmer's Table, which is Farmer's Table isn't a chain, is it?
No, it's just a local.
It's one location on in the Rittenhouse neighborhood.
Yeah.
And just like at Chipotle, you can choose. There's a big assortment of vegetables and more sustainable meats and grains. It's
really good.
It's the wave of the future, I think, for convenience food. Or at least I
think you're right.
Anyway, you and I do not exactly patronize a fast food establishment that often,
no.
But that doesn't mean that we don't want to get dinner together fast sometimes.
True enough.
So today I think we are going to explore how we do that. How do we get dinner
That's
on the
right.
table fast, even when we don't feel like it? What are some of your shortcuts?
The good old rotisserie chicken from the grocery store. I know that's one of your favorites,
Me
too.
I buy one every other week.
Yeah. I'm not that reliable, but I'll certainly, if I'm feeling pinched and I don't want to succumb to, like, Chipotle, which, there is one in walking distance of my home, I will definitely buy a pre-cooked chicken and make a salad of some stripe or another and call it good. Another one of my favorite, like, I don't feel like cooking, is even just scrambled eggs. You know, scrambled eggs, maybe a vegetable on the side or a piece of toast, and I'm happy.
Another thing I like to do is anticipate those times when I'm not going to feel like cooking. Today is a very busy day for me.
Yeah.
And I know I'm going to be working right up until the minute Dan comes home from work. So I have some chili defrosting in my fridge that I make a big, huge batch of it and squirrel it away. And I do the same thing with soups, pulled pork, as we recently discussed on another episode, beans. I make lots of stuff to put away in the freezer to just bail me out. Although you do have to know about a day in advance because you want things to thaw. But that is always very helpful for me.
You're lucky in that you have a secondary freezer. I don't have as much freezer space. And so like the freezer, homemade freezer meals aren't as easy for me to produce. But I do have, because I do a lot of canning, I go to my pantry for quick things too. Like I'll often do like a chicken fajita salad. And so I'll buy chopped up already bagged lettuce, which I know is such a cheat, but it makes life easier. And open up a can of beans, saute up some chicken and some vegetables, and then throw everything on top of that lettuce. And then I'll pull out a jar of homemade salsa, which makes it feel more like a meal than just I quickly sauteed up some vegetables and dumped it over lettuce.
Right. I don't think there's any shame in a chopped veg.
Yeah.
I love to pick up that broccoli slaw because it stays good a long time.
Yeah.
You can cook it or eat it raw. It stands up to dressing if you want to pack it and have it for lunch even the next day, which is just – it's great at broccoli stems and carrots usually. Yeah. That's one of my favorite quick things. And lately I've also been into hot dogs. The Great Organic Beef Hot Dog from Applegate, I believe it is. Uh-huh. Those things are tasty and have very few ingredients. And
that's awesome.
Only about 100 calories per. It's less calories and fat than a usual hot dog, and nothing that I feel bad about eating. So,
yeah, no, that's a good one. I also, along similar lines, we'd mentioned rotisserie chicken. I will also, Trader Joe's, which is two blocks from my home, sells packaged, pre-cooked grilled chicken breasts, which is... Again, I often feel a little bit shameful buying it, which I know I shouldn't, but it's like, oh, I could cook this chicken myself. I will buy that and chop it up and like toss it with some grains and vegetables and call it a grain salad.
I think a useful way to think about it instead of cheating is the idea that instead of cooking something necessarily from scratch, you're doing like a collage of a meal,
a little
assembly of things that you either bought or made before and have hanging around. I think it takes a lot of the pressure off. When it comes to getting dinner together.
It's true. I guess I have that semi-homemade backlash feeling where I don't want to be doing anything that I thought Sandra Lee might have done.
Right, so. Right. I know. There's even more pressure when you are sort of in the food world. You know, my husband, for one, is extremely spoiled. and me too. I really expect something nice for dinner every night. I want it to be an event and a highlight of the day.
No, I understand that. But, you know, not every dinner needs to be memorable. Sometimes you just need to eat.
I know.
And that I tell myself that a lot. Like tonight, I'm heading out of town again soon, and it's going to be clean out the refrigerator fried rice with leftover rice from Chinese food a couple nights ago. And that's okay.
Yeah. Sometimes you just need a sustaining, non-memorable, non-food-tastic meal.
It's true. Now, speaking of meals and things that inspire our meals, let's talk a little bit about our favorite cookbooks. And these are the ones that we go back to over and over again. You know, the cookbooks that never let us down.
Now, we both obviously love cookbooks.
Yes.
We've both written cookbooks. There is, though, a difference between you and me when it comes to cookbooks. And that is, you have in your home... hundreds? Is it safe to say hundreds?
I would say hundreds, yes.
I think we're going to need to take a picture of that and post it to the site so that people can see the collection. It's pretty impressive.
It's a little obscene, I'll admit that. And, you know, part of it is doing what I do, I get a lot of review copies, but I don't keep all of them. I only keep the ones that I feel like are worthy, even still.
I also love cookbooks, but I have maybe 10 in my house.
You are an amazing pare down.
I'm an aggressive purger. I, too, get review copies and give them away or donate them frequently. And sometimes I have to say I don't want one, which is painful. I hate to not give up the opportunity to look at a cookbook, but my house is very small. And I think you probably have most, if not all, of the 10 that I have. We have a lot of shared favorites.
That's true.
Which I think brings us to what I know is your favorite.
I am a Joy of Cooking loyalist. I love the Joy of Cooking. It was the cookbook I grew up with. It was the Bible in my household. And it's funny because the copy I grew up with was a gift to my mother from my paternal grandmother. So my mother's mother-in-law gave it to her when my parents had only been married a couple of years. And initially my mom was really insulted by the gift because she felt like it meant that she didn't know how to cook. And to be frank, she didn't. You know, this was the early 70s. My parents got married young and they didn't know how to feed themselves. And so my grandmother gave my mom a copy of The Joy of Cooking. And it became the primary cooking resource in my home. You know, I taught myself how to make crepes from The Joy of Cooking when I was 11 years old because I was homesick from school and wanted to do something. And so it has been the reference in terms of cooking for me. And because I love it so much, I actually have 5 copies. Various editions. I don't have all 5 of the same one, but I love that book.
That's incredible to me.
It's insane.
I had the older edition, and then when did the new one come out? 2010? In the last 5 or 7 years. And then when I got the new edition, discard with the old one.
I like having sort of, you know, different incarnations to see how there's been change over time.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that is interesting. And it sort of brings me to thinking about my pick for my all-time favorite cookbook, which is Deborah Madison's Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. A new edition of that book recently came out, I think, just this year or last year.
Yeah, in the last year, I think.
And I actually agonized a little bit over whether to get the new edition because I knew if I did get the new edition, I'd have to discard my old one. And my sentimental attachment to that copy is fierce. It's probably the first cookbook that I got after Dan and I met and the primary one that we have cooked from. And there's notes. I have so many notes to myself written all over the pages. It's just...
You can't give that up.
It's like the last thing we pack when we move. We we don't call this book Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. We call it Deborah. If Dan is going to start making pancakes or something on a weekend morning, he goes into the kitchen and he'll say, "Hey, can you get Deborah?" And I'll just bring it out there. I mean, and to me, the thing that I love most about this book, it's a big book. It's like a 600-page book. And every time I page through it, I feel like it is a new book, even though it's not the book that is changing. It's me that's changing. New recipes appeal to me. I find little sticky notes that I've flagged in the past where I'm like, oh, who wanted to make that? Not me. But in preparation for this conversation, I did that again. I sat down with the book. I paged through it. I saw a recipe that I have never noticed before. It was a delicious gratin of potatoes and mushrooms with cream.
That sounds good.
It was so good. It was 2 thin layers of potatoes with a middle filling section of fresh mushrooms and dried mushrooms and half and half and garlic.
Sounds amazing.
Oh, it is amazing. And it's sort of like now a new favorite from the book. And I was hoping that you would tell me about some of your favorites from Joy of Cooking.
Well, I tend to turn to Joy of Cooking more for baked goods. So it is my resource for things like banana bread. And which is strange because, I mean, there are a million recipes out there for banana bread. And I go to the recipe each time I make it, even though I know that I'm going to tweak it significantly every time I do. But I go to it for banana bread. I go to it for things like biscuits, even though I don't really make biscuits that often anymore. But if I'm having people over for breakfast, one of my favorite things to do is a jam bar and whole wheat biscuits. It's delicious. Ooh. It's very fun. It's an easy breakfast. Maybe some hard-boiled eggs on the side or something. And it's also the place I turn if I need to do something like cook a piece of meat that I've never cooked before. I'll go to the Joy of Cooking to see their instructions. Or if I'm roasting a turkey, because that's where my parents get their turkey roasting information every year at Thanksgiving and Christmas. It is the annual consulting of the Joy of Cooking to figure out how long the turkey's going to take in the oven.
Very often when I get a recipe development assignment as part of my research, I look up the recipe for whatever it is in Joy of Cooking under the, you know, theory that that's how other people do it, or that's sort of like a gold standard of something that works. It's definitely a reference in that way.
Yeah.
Well, we'd love to hear about your favorite cookbooks.
Absolutely.
If you will come to localmouthful.com and leave us a comment under the show notes for today's episode. We would just be very interested to hear what's the last cookbook you pack when you move. And now let's welcome our guest, Amanda Pfeiffer, who has a new cookbook coming out this fall that we're very excited about. She's the author of the fermentation blog Fickle at fickle.com. That's P-H-I-C-K-L.com. And her book, which is coming out in October, will be called Ferment Your Vegetables. Welcome, Amanda. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Joy and Marisa.
So I think that the first thing we should address is how, in today's modern age, with everything available at your fingertips and the gourmet grocer, you got into fermenting your own food.
It's kind of a boring story, but if you will bear with me. Essentially, I worked in the food industry, the evil one, not the restaurant one, for a long time, for 7 years. And I worked on some fermented products, but the way fermented products are made in the commercial production is, to my thinking now, very ridiculous. And even at the time, it struck me as odd. So I started to kind of explore.
What was ridiculous about it?
Okay, so basically, I'm talking about yogurt right now. And the way that commercial yogurt is usually made is it's fermented because it has to be fermented. And then they kill it. So they pasteurize it. It's already pasteurized, made with pasteurized milk, but they cook it to a temperature at which the bacteria can no longer live. And then in order to be able to say that it's probiotic, or say, you know, 50,000 live active cultures or whatever they're claiming, they add probiotics back in. And it makes sense from a commercial standpoint. If you're processing, you know, billions of tons of milk every year, you need something that's going to be shelf stable. And the way that I make yogurt, it's not shelf stable. My lids will get puffy for weeks, maybe even months in the refrigerator.
Why do the lids get puffy?
Because it's still fermenting. The bacteria that they're selecting are bacteria that aren't going to be active, or they have very specifically measured the remaining sugar content or used non-digestible sugars or whatever it is. There's lots of ways that they can do it so that it's not going to continue to change.
So are you saying that yogurt that you ferment on your own is more natural?
I mean, natural is a difficult term, especially with my background, because it doesn't have any meaning. It does have some legal meaning, actually, specifically because I come from the flavor industry and natural flavors have a specific legal designation. But most food companies can put the natural label on anything they want to put it on, and nobody's going to say, no, it's not, because it's not a legal designation.
Is it a matter of flavor?
Flavor, for sure. I mean, there's so many different aspects to – there's so many differences is what I mean to say. The strains of bacteria that are going to be present in a yogurt that I'm fermenting, let's say with an heirloom strain of yogurt, there's going to be a very broad diversity of bacteria that are doing that. The legal definition in the U.S. only requires 2 or 3 bacteria to make it be yogurt. That's not a very diverse population. And there's a really interesting anecdote, I think, that Sander Katz has, which was exactly the same thing that happened to me. When I started fermenting yogurt 10 or so years ago, I would use store-bought yogurt, like the best store-bought yogurt I could find, and I would let it culture, and I would reculture it. I would backslop, as the term is. And eventually it would just be liquid. It wouldn't set up properly. And I would always think, oh, I left it in the fridge too long, or I did something wrong. But as it turns out, it's because the strains themselves were not diverse enough to support life. That's why microbial diversity makes a lot of sense. That's why it's necessary to sustain fermented foods, because if one bacteria gets a little tired or angry and dies out, there's a backup system in place with heirloom yogurt. There's lots and lots of different bacteria that can cover little bits of each other's roles. When you're only using 2 strains, there's nobody there if something goes wrong.
Where did you get your heirloom bacteria for your yogurt culture?
I have a lot of yogurt cultures, but several of them I've gotten from culturesforhealth.com. They sell like a ton of different strains, and it's fun to play around, and you can see the massive differences from one to another. One will be basically liquid. Another one will be super thick. Some are gelatinous. They're really very diverse, and they're all yogurt. They're all fermented milk.
Do you think that yogurt is an ideal first fermentation project?
I don't, actually.
What would you recommend?
I think sauerkraut or some kind of pickled vegetable. Not pickled cucumbers, please, but maybe like pickled radishes. That's always kind of my first recommendation for people that enjoy eating radishes, because it's very easy. It's faster than sauerkraut. Sauerkraut, usually you want to wait about a month. Pickled, you can wait, you know, 10 days and have something really tasty. Yogurt, the only reason I don't recommend it up front is because you have to find a way to maintain heat if you're using a what's called a thermophilic culture, so a culture that needs to culture at a high sustained temperature. And that's what most people are going to start with. Most people are going to go to the grocery store. And pretty much everything that I'm aware of on the grocery store shelves is thermophilic as opposed to mesophilic, which cultures at room temperature.
Can you just tell us how the basics to how you would ferment those radishes if you were undertaking a
sure
that as a first project?
So you would chop the radishes, trim them, rinse them in cool water, put them in a jar, stir some salt into filtered water, and then pour the filtered water over the radishes in the jar and apply some kind of weight to keep the radishes submerged under the layer of brine. Put your lid back on loosely. CO2 is going to be created in the fermenting process, so it needs a place to escape to. And let it sit at room temperature for about a week, maybe two.
That sounds pretty easy.
It's extremely easy. Highly recommend it.
Why do you think there's this surge in popularity for fermenting at home?
I think there's a few reasons. I think it's kind of a reaction to fast food, appropriately for this particular podcast. It's the ultimate slow food. There's nothing slower. You can't rush it. The flavors will not happen if you try to make it go faster. They just won't. Fermentation is very specific about time. I also think, obviously, the healthy sheen of fermented vegetables, that makes me a little nervous as a fermenter because I think, like anything else, there's going to be an upside and a downside. And we know about the upside right now, and we don't know that much about potential other things that are happening with fermented vegetables. So I think people get a little bit fanatical about how healthy this is. It's so good for me. It's so good for me. And they don't really pay attention to how it makes them feel. And then that's when we start to run into problems. So I do think, but to answer your question concisely, yeah, I think the health aspects and kind of the reaction to fast food are probably the two most important reasons.
Have you noticed a change in your own health or well-being since you've started eating a fair amount of fermented foods?
Yes, I do not get sick. I was sick last year for the first time in forever, and I had a class the next day, and I was like, I'm going to have to cancel my class. This is crazy. I just don't get sick. And I was down for like 3 hours. Like, I had a fever, but then it was gone in 3 hours, and I was fine. I didn't, like, treat it with anything. I just, like, rested.
Wow.
So, yeah, I really don't get sick. Knocking on wood.
Well, I'm very excited about the forthcoming book. I was hoping that you could tell us all about it. What are the highlights? What can we expect? Who is it right for?
Sure. I am also very excited about the book. Thank you for mentioning it. So I'll tell you a little that maybe the chapters, because I feel like that gives a good view of how I arranged it and who it's for. So it's like pickles, sauerkrauts, kimchi, kvass, which is a fermented vegetable drink. It's generally made with beets, but I made it with all kinds of different vegetables. I did a condiments section, which is all wild fermented. I didn't add any whey or any other kinds of starters. And then in the more advanced technique section, there's a fermenting without salt. There's a using crocks and fermenting in crocks. And alternative paths to fermentation nirvana is the last chapter. So that's an overview of different types of fermenting practice, vegetable fermenting practices from around the world.
So it would be appropriate for the beginning fermenter like me, or yes, maybe the more advanced fermenter like Marisa.
Yep, absolutely. It's intended to be for both. And part of the way that I approached that was to have very specific recipes, but also to encourage people to take the basic principles and run with them. And that's my philosophy with fermentation anyway. It's not that you have to listen to anybody else's specific way of doing things, because there are a lot of ways that work.
Is it currently available for pre-order?
It is. You can buy it anywhere you would normally buy stuff. Barnes & Noble, Amazon. There's a little link on my blog. You can find it anywhere.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you sharing that fermentation knowledge with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Amanda Pfeiffer, the writer behind the blog Fickle and the cookbook Ferment Your Vegetables. And now, let's take a look in our shopping carts and talk about something we found at the market this week. Marisa, your turn.
All right. Well, it is tomato season, and so we are finally starting to get really great tomatoes in the markets. And so I made my first just basic plain tomato salad last night, which is nothing special, and yet it is delicious. And I'm sure everybody has a variation. You know, I used grape tomatoes and cut them up, added some chopped sweet onion, a little basil, and then salt, pepper, and olive oil. I didn't even do any sort of acid because the tomatoes just release enough to make it delicious. And we ate it with homemade pizza, which was kind of awesome and delicious. But it's also something that you could serve with chicken. You could add some corn and make it into sort of a tomato and corn relish. It's a super versatile little side salad that doesn't take much time, and it highlights tomatoes like nothing else.
I just love tomatoes as well. I haven't made the starring the tomato salad as yet, but I did make a tomato salsa, which was just what I like to do for my salsa is I get a cast iron pan super, super hot, and I put a half of a red onion down in it and a couple jalapenos. Mm-hmm. And I get those nice and charred on the exterior.
Oh my God, I like where you're going.
And then I throw it all in the blender with some of these beautiful tomatoes and cilantro, and it's then finished with lime juice. And it's just, ate it up so fast, I didn't even get to use it for when I intended it. We were just spooning it on scrambled eggs every day, and it was just a superstar. I need to make more. Although there's obviously no end of things that are delicious with tomatoes.
It's true. This is the time of year when I kind of try to just eat a tomato every day in some form because they are at sort of their zenith right now. And we've got another month before they're going to be disappearing. And it's funny because I used to be allergic to tomatoes when I was a kid. I was allergic to raw tomatoes. I got a rash if I touched them on my hands, and they made me really nauseous. And I have never been more grateful to grow out of an allergy than my tomato allergy. And now I feel like I have to make up for lost time. I'm also very happy to be heading into the time where tomatoes are so abundant that you can start doing things to preserve them. So every year I make tomato jam, which is delicious. I make slow roasted tomatoes, which is a little insane, but what I do is I line cookie sheets with parchment paper. I cut like a Roma or a plum tomato in half. I drizzle it with just a little bit of olive oil, tuck garlic cloves in, and then put my oven at its lowest temperature possible and roast them for like 8 to 10 hours. And they turn into like candy.
I've done that as well.
It's so
good. Really delicious.
And then I freeze them in little packages so that I can defrost them and either put them on pizza or scramble them with eggs or make dip out of them all year. So good.
Another of my favorite things to do this time of year is to take just a fistful of those beautiful sun gold tomatoes. Uh-huh. And I put them in the blender with red wine vinegar, a shallot, and some olive oil, and just blend it in the blender. And then you get a beautiful, smooth, tomatoey vinaigrette, which is good on just about everything.
That sounds amazing.
Salads, meats, fish, vegetables.
I can imagine that in like a grain salad. I'm a little fixated on grain salads these days.
Right. It just takes a minute to make, and it is, I think, a beautiful expression of that sun gold tomato. It's really bright and yellow and summery.
Those are one of my favorites, too.
Summer in a glass.
Sounds delicious.
I think that about does it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening to us. Please make sure to follow us on Twitter at Local Mouthful. And don't forget to sign up for our newsletter where you can catch up on all of our episodes and show notes. Also visit us at localmouthful.com. And don't forget to tell us about your favorite cookbooks. Until next time, happy eating.
Thank you.